Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And tonight, Condoleezza Rice will be delivering a speech just before the keynote speech of Paul Ryan's at the Republican Convention in Tampa, Florida. Last night, Mitt Romney sat between his wife and Condoleezza Rice. There's no question that she's being featured fairly heavily in this convention, and she's somewhat of a star, I understand, in Republican circles, particularly a recent Koch brothers fundraiser. Apparently she knocked it out of the ballpark. How do you see her influence, even though she's very adamant that she's not doesn't want a role in this administration if it's to come to be? But she, on the one hand, seems to have a lot of influence. But my understanding of most of Mitt Romney's foreign policy team is that they're basically the recycled neocons from the Bush administration.
Dr. Rice has a Chevron oil company tanker named after her. She's a perfect symbol for the corporatocracy that the Republican Party, in essence, outside the Tea Party and its extreme right wing, has come to represent. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, and a host of other billionaires like them wanting Mitt Romney in office because Mitt Romney promises to let them go on with what they've been doing for the past couple of decades. And let's not just blame George W. Bush for this, because Bill Clinton sort of started it, raping and pillaging not only America, but the rest of the world with their predatory form of capitalism. I mean, that's what this is all about. Condi Rice is a perfect example of what I'm talking about.
Well, interesting, you know, in terms of oil tankers, there was a piece in yesterday's New York Times business section about how the U.S. Navy has been trying to diversify its fuel portfolio to have alternative fuel, because there's a possibility of a war in the Gulf, as we know from the Israeli press. There's a lot of talk about this, and if the Straits of Hormuz are closed, then the price of oil goes up, and the Navy, quite understandably, is looking for alternative sources from a dependence upon gasoline. And now we learn that the Republican Congress is putting the Secretary of the Navy on the hot seat. How dare you try and give up on oil? You're not the Secretary of Energy, et cetera. I mean, I find it dumbfounding that
it's incredible. We just had Ray Mabus, Secretary of the Navy, up at Boston at our conference, Collaborative Institute on Oceans, Climate, and Science conference, and some of the things he said were quite stunning. I mean, they were very commonsensical, very pragmatic, and put the Navy and DOD by implication at the head of all those government institutions working on things like climate change and alternative energy and so forth. So as you said, here we have the Republicans in the worship of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, the CEO there, who said Kazakhstan's a better place than America, in absolute thrall to these guys who give them all their money, and whom Condi Rice, of course, as I said, represents. That's where we're going. I mean, that's what the Republican Party's challenge is to DOD now, is get off biofuel, get off alternative fuels, get off all the things you're trying to do to help us meet the future. Because let's face it, DOD has been at the spearhead of everything that's happened in this country since World War II in terms of innovation, whether we're talking the internet, stealth technology, whatever. You take DOD off this track and you take one of the most well-resourced, powerful, and self-interested, but enlightened self-interest, organizations the federal government has to throw at this problem. And it is incredible, as you just said. It's insanity.
So what do you make then, Colonel Wilkerson, of what Condoleezza Rice said on CBS's This Morning program, when she was asked what President Obama had done wrong in global affairs. She said, there is no doubt that the United States' voice has been muted. When the United States' voice is muted, the world is a more dangerous place. I mean, I find it breathtaking because my understanding is that the legacy of the Bush administration is, in terms of these wars, has basically been that the United States is not so much muted, but we're sort of, in many ways, a spent force.
Well, she's right in one sense, but not the sense she meant. She's right that the arrogant, unilateralist voice of George W. Bush, Richard Cheney, and Condoleezza Rice has been muted, thank God. If I give President Obama credit for anything, and I'm as strident a critic of him as probably anybody you will talk to, particularly with regard to his failures with respect to the financial and economic situation we're still deeply mired in. But the one thing he has done, positive thing, absolutely positive thing, is restore, somewhat at least, because George W. Bush and Dick Cheney took it down so low, our reputation in the world with regard particularly to Europe, but also with regard to Asia, Latin America, and so forth. We have restored some of the ability of the United States to influence other people, from Germany to Japan to Brazil. And that's to the credit of President Obama. So, yes, he has muted the voice of arrogance and unilateralism that Condi and George and Dick brought to the White House. But that's a positive thing in my view, and I think in most Americans' view.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. Now, there is a lot of talk, as I mentioned, Colonel Wilkerson, in the Israeli press about almost an inevitability that Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Barak have made up their mind to attack Iran before the elections. I've talked to a lot of people in Israel about this and tried to get some sense out of it, because on the surface it doesn't make any sense that just as the Assads are on the rope and Hezbollah is isolated and Iran is isolated, an attack on Iran would reverse that situation, which ostensibly seems to be working in Israel's favor. What's your reading on what's going on?
I'm somewhat concerned about what you just said, but from another perspective, I believe that instead of isolating Iran, as we've been trying to do with our diplomacy and other measures over the past year or 2 years, and proof of the pudding that we haven't succeeded is the non-aligned movement being there right now with over 40 ministers, heads of state, and even the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon there, although today he used the opportunity to chide Khomeini about the nuclear program. But instead of isolating Iran, what's happened is we've isolated, we, Netanyahu and Lieberman and Barak and others in Israel in this leadership, have isolated Israel. You sit down and think about it for a moment. Whom does Israel have for a friend in the world today besides the United States? No one. Zero. This administration in Tel Aviv has made a decision that international relations, as it were, have no significance for Israel. They have said it doesn't matter what anybody else in the world thinks. That's frightening. And if there is any prospect that Netanyahu and Barak would launch a strike against Iran prior to the elections in this country in November, that is part of it because they are so isolated. We even have people self-immolating in Israel right now as a response to the austerity program that Netanyahu has implemented. Where do you see that written about in the American press? You don't. They're isolated not only domestically but internationally, and what do you do when you're isolated like that and you're, you know, somewhat off balance? You do nutty things like attack Iran, and so I am concerned that there might be an October surprise, so to speak, and we might wake up and Israel will have attacked Iran.
But it's hard to determine whether how an attack on Iran, we know it will affect the elections, and there's a great deal of suspicion that that is the intention on the part of Netanyahu, and there's a lot of understanding, I think, that there's a long relationship between Netanyahu and Romney, and we know that Adelson, the biggest donor to Romney's campaign, has devoted his fortune, if you will, to Netanyahu. But as you, as a retired U.S. Army colonel, can tell us, you know, you can't predict how these things will work out. So, if they did it before the election, who are they trying to help?
Here's the interesting thing about this. It might seem a bit counterintuitive. I think the Israelis, in terms of their leadership, and this includes Netanyahu and Barak, I think they have decided Obama's going to win, or that's the most likely outcome. What better way to ensure that they get at least a modicum of what they want and to give Obama a bounce in the polls at the last minute that might be an unbeatable one, that is, it could not be overwhelmed by Romney, by attacking Iran, and Obama has to go along with it and has to seem supportive of it, which I think if they do it before the election, he would have no choice but to be. That doesn't mean we follow up with U.S. strikes. I don't even think Israel would want that, because the retaliation from Iran will be limited if Israel is the only one who strikes. Whereas if we strike massively, the retaliation will be region-wide and against all of us. So it's an interesting question. In a political sense, it's a very opportunistic moment for Netanyahu to get what he wants and to have the inevitability of an Obama victory, which I think they think is going to happen anyway, be more or less overcome, for the moment at least, by the fact that they've already conducted the attack and they say, okay, what you're going to do now?
So in this little diversionary war, I assume the calculus is that Iran would not close the Straits of Hormuz. That would be an escalation that would almost guarantee the U.S. intervention.
I think so. And I think Israel would probably be dissuasive towards us with regard to any follow-up by us, even if we seem like we wanted to do it. And that's the very reason, because I think Israel simply does not have the capacity to do very much damage to Iran. Not only that, if Iran just takes it and doesn't respond in any significant way, where do you think international opinion is going to shift? I would predict it'll shift majorly towards Iran and away from us and the West in general, and certainly away from Israel, where it has already shifted majorly. So Iran comes out of a strike by Israel with no follow-up by the United States, looking pretty good and being in a better position internationally than she would be if Israel didn't strike at all. So if I were in Iran, I'd be sitting there thinking to myself, well, go ahead, Israel. We'll see what happens.
Well, but that analysis makes the whole thing even more counterproductive, counterintuitive, and somewhat insane.
Precisely. And that's the reason I'm getting worried, because all of these insanities add up to a situation where you're painted into a corner, it all unfolds, and then you've got to figure out what to do next. The question in my mind, if a scenario like this were to develop, would be what would President Obama do in February or March or April after the intelligence community tells him, as a result of the Israeli strike, the Ayatollah has made a decision to develop a nuclear weapon? Because he hasn't made that decision now. Our intelligence community is right on that, and so is Britain's and France's and Germany's and others. They have not made a decision to weaponize. Israel attacks, we attack, regardless of who attacks, they're going to make that decision, I think. So Israel would have produced in the long run exactly what she was attacking to stop.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. Well, certainly a lot to think about here. I'm sort of somewhat numb, but let's return to the convention down in Florida and the Condoleezza Rice speech tonight, followed by Paul Ryan's. I'm astounded by Romney's lack of curiosity about foreign policy. You would think that somebody that's been essentially running for president for the last 10 years would have really done some serious tutorials on foreign policy. But it doesn't appear that he has. It appears that he has a kind of corporate CEO attitude that you just outsource it. You know, you have a vice president in charge of foreign policy. Is that how he's going to run the show if he gets the nomination? I mean, if he wins the election?
He certainly worries me. A man who goes to the United Kingdom on the eve of the Olympics and tells them that he doesn't think they're ready and he doesn't think they've done as good a job as he did in Salt Lake, or by implication says that, is not a man I want conducting diplomacy and political relations for the United States. So if anything turned me off, I really had not made my decision about for whom I was going to vote in this election. I'm still a Republican. I think that performance in the United Kingdom and other things that are happening right now, and particularly with regard, as you just mentioned, to foreign policy and security policy, are going to put me holding my nose and going into the booth and voting again for a Democrat.
So, and the fact that his most of his foreign policy team appear to be these neoconservatives.
I've seen them before.
Right.
I've been around them before.
You've seen that movie.
I know the Boltons. I know these guys and gals. And I don't want to see him. Elliot Abrams, a convicted felon, as far as I know,
right.
Or he should be. I don't want any of these people anywhere near U.S. foreign policy, and my fear is that they might be.
But in terms of holding your nose for Barack Obama, your disappointment in Obama is largely that, I take it, that he did not distance himself from the Bush administration in terms of the torture issue. He didn't follow through on his promises to close Guantanamo, and instead has inherited the kind of executive branch with the powers that Dick Cheney usurped somewhat gleefully.
There are two issues there, Ian, that spread out into many issues, but one is, as you've just said, it's his Justice Department. Yeah. Eric Holder standing up, I think it was at Northwestern University, and saying due process does not, as in the Fourth Amendment and in the Constitution, does not necessarily include judicial process, blew me off my chair. I mean, here we go, killing American citizens with due process being defined as a star chamber. That's the one issue, the Patriot Act, the FISA amendments, all of that wrapped up in that. And then the other is the economic and fiscal situation that we're in, which we really have done nothing except briefly ameliorate. Europe's getting ready to probably stick an accelerant into this process that's going to be awesome. And from everything I'm hearing from Beijing and from Shanghai, the Chinese are getting ready to collapse, too, in a real significant sense. Collapse for the Chinese means being unable to meet the 10, 11, 12% annual growth rate and going down to something more like 4 or 5. There was a wonderful op-ed in the Financial Times recently, which incidentally is about the only newspaper I read anymore. It isn't owned by some corporate guru. The Financial Times op-ed held that the criticism of Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan about Obama allowing the United States to become second in the world to China is farcical, first, because even if China's GDP surpasses ours, we're still four times richer than they are because we're one-fourth their size. And second, we better pray that China doesn't start falling off in terms of annual growth, because that's what's sustaining the world economy right now. So you throw China's relapse into Europe's failure, and we're going to have a global depression, the likes of which we've not seen in two or three centuries. And I don't see this administration even recognizing that, let alone putting in place the policies that would take care of it, or at least begin to ameliorate it.
Well, you'd think, you know, it's often been said that Angela Merkel holds Obama's fate in her hands. I'm sure that they're aware of it, but, you'd think just out of pure survival they'd be thinking about it if it happens before the elections.
Yes. They must be sitting there just every night saying their prayers, and their prayers must go something like, please don't let it happen before November.
And that applies to Netanyahu as well.
Yes, exactly.
What a situation. I thank you so much for joining us, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to the United States Secretary of State, Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll go back to Tampa, Florida, and speak with a Wisconsinite, John Nichols, about the Wisconsin contingent. Governor Walker, the head of the RNC, Reince Priebus, and tonight's keynote speaker, Paul Ryan.